You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Go Wild. Go Wild is the fastest growing social media application for outdoor enthusiasts, and it's designed by outdoor enthusiasts. If you want more information, visit Google Play Store and download the app, or visit timetogowild.com. Let's get outside. It's time to go wild.
Welcome to the For Love of the Land Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
Each week, we're interviewing guests from across America. They all have one thing in common. They all are tied to the land. So if you're like us and you love all things land, welcome home.
All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us for another For Love of the Land podcast right here. And I'm your host, Adam Keith, as you already know. And if you've listened to the other podcasts this week, you are aware that Matt Dye is actually out traveling this week for the holidays with his family in Virginia. And so, therefore, here I am. It's kind of interesting for the listeners. Last week, Matt pretty well carried the load with the podcast, and maybe, and the week prior. I was on last week, but we covered a property that he actually worked. So I've been kind of out of it for the last couple weeks because of the birth of my first daughter, or first kid, who happens to be a daughter. So this week, Matt's kind of traveling, and I have Chad filling in for Matt as we're covering For Love the Land podcast, which, as you know, I believe we're on the fourth one now, and we have not touched on anything hunting, which is kind of the purpose of this podcast. We've really just covered and talked about different stories. We had Tyler Ross, and we had Sean Clarkson. And this week is really kind of a conversation between Chad and I about our family farm. There's kind of an interesting history there, and kind of really that's the purpose of this podcast, is to talk about some of our stories with farming, ranching, hunting, land, fishing, whatever it is, all ties back to the land. So, Chad, thanks for joining us again. You filled in a lot over this fall.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Between all the stuff you guys have going on, it seems to
work out with me. Dumber and dumber, because we just keep adding podcasts to the mix. Frankly, because we really, really enjoy the podcast, but also it's a great way for us to connect with people and share stories and hopefully inspire people to become landowners or get involved with public lands and all things land. So, it's part of it. As we expand and do more things, there's going to be more and more guest appearances from people. And since you're so intertwined with everything, you'll be around more and more.
The purpose of the podcast is to draw. You're trying to draw more people than just deer hunters.
Yeah,
to be able to give something to people that aren't necessarily solely into deer hunting, that are looking into, that just love land as much as we do.
That's right.
Honestly.
So if you're driving a tractor or combine, hopefully this will be a podcast that you want to listen to. All right, going ahead and jumping right in, for the guys listening, there won't be, due to the holidays, this is going to be released on New Year's Day, so it record during the week of Christmas. So a lot of agents are traveling. A lot of people are kind of taking off for the holidays. So we decided, we didn't decide it until we tried to make contact with a few agents and weren't able to do so. So this week we are not interviewing any agents for their listings. We're just going to chalk it up as a holiday season, and we'll be getting more agents on next week. But since everybody else is telling their story about land and how they got connected, Chad and I, brothers, have an interesting story with our family farm. So our family farm is located in southern Missouri in the Ozark Highlands, kind of the break of the Ozark Plateau and the Plateau region of the Ozark Mountains. So I think
you go north just a few miles and you're to where it's more the pasture ground, kind of flatter, it's more rolling. And
yep.
then, I mean, right around the farm is when you really start to see more of the steeper slopes around the
That's right.
around
We're
Bryant.
Kind of the break of for people listening out of Missouri or out of the area in other states. Missouri is kind of it's a unique state because of the fact that you go to the northern part and it is as flat, and you go to the tall grass side of the prairie, and then you kind of go into the central and you get into kind of the short grass prairie, and I guess tall grass prairie is a lot of the western side of the state too, out towards Kansas. So, but then you go to the south side, specifically the southwest side, and you get into the Ozark Mountains, and a lot of terrain changes, a lot of hills, a lot of steep, rocky, gnarly rock outcroppings, and so it's an interesting state when you speak from the terrain side.
I'm sure you encounter it all the time too, but like through my work, I working in Arkansas, when I would tell people I'm from Missouri and deer hunting, they're like, oh, you're from the land of the big bucks up there in crop country. And I'm like, no, our place compares more to northern Arkansas than it does to northern Missouri.
That's right. That's right. And so our background, or a lot of the people that settled southern Missouri, really came from West Virginia and Virginia and North Carolina, kind of that Scotch-Irish background. When they first came over on the boats, they settled in East Coast, and as settlement pushed west, a lot of them came to southern Missouri because of its likeliness to the same terrain as West Virginia and Virginia, because of the rocky terrain changes. A lot of moonshining, but also just a lot of small hobby farms that you had some cows, you had some horses, you had goats and chickens, and sheep and pigs, but you kind of worked the ground the best you could. And it was really no different for our family, Scotch-Irish background that came to southern Missouri because of its similarities with where they came from. Being rocky ground, they knew how to farm it, or so they thought.
Well, and it's crazy to think of, like, ever since we've been growing up on that farm, it's been fescue pasture.
Yes.
I mean, the whole part of it. And then you hear even Dad telling stories of, oh, yeah, that the what they call the ball diamond. Well, they planted sorghum in that.
Yeah.
Or they planted this. And it's like, really?
They planted sorghum there, and then just off the family farm in the bottoms, they planted some corn. And, of course, they planted the sorghum and, of course, the sugar canes. Yeah, they did all kinds of stuff. Moonshining was popular. I said that earlier. And whether it was legal or not, they still did it. We had ancestors that did it. But our family actually came to southern Missouri in the late 1870s, early 1880s. The first ancestor that moved in and actually settled the farm just northwest of our family farm. And Chad, you can chime in anytime I'm forgetting anything in this story.
Yeah.
And so basically he settled just off the family farm, and that was our great-great-grandpa. And as he settled there, and then as they had kids, the sons moved and bought the farms adjoining. And so some sons went to the north, and some went kind of to the northeast. But our great-grandpa had a portion of the farm, the kind of the original farm that we have now, during the 1890s and in 1890, or I guess the 1880s, and in 1892, he sold that farm, a portion of it, to the Stark brothers. And we actually have the abstract of title, which shows the kind of the ownership changing over the years. And in 1892, our great-granddad sold the original part of what is now the family farm to Stark Brothers for an interesting price. Right, Chad?
Yeah.
You wouldn't...
I would like to be able to buy some land for that price.
Yeah, no doubt. I would be harvesting and doing all kinds of cool things to buy land if you could buy it for the exchange that was taking place, and kind of look back at great grandpa and say, man, there must have been a lot of value to those. But he actually sold the, and I think it was 80 acres, correct?
I believe so. That's I'm not sure.
I wish I had it in front of me, but I don't. I think it's at my grandma's house, but he sold the original acreage to the Stark brothers for 1,000 fruit trees. And I think people would say, what? But Stark brothers actually are a fruit tree company, and you can Google them and check it out. I think it is Stark Brothers Nurseries or Stark Brothers Fruit Trees.
I think it's either Stark or Stark's Brothers.
Stark Brothers, yeah. And anyway, I'm trying to Google it right now as we're on the phone, but it's Stark Brothers or Stark Bros. Starkbros. And they've been in business since 1816. So they've been around a long, long time. And anyway, fruit trees. That's what's so interesting to me about the background of Southern Missouri is the tomato factories and the fruit factories and the fruit orchards. I mean, I, being a real estate agent, United Country has been in business since 1925. And in 1928, they did the first ever catalog of listings in the area or in the state of Missouri and northern Arkansas. And it's dominated the listings in our area. Wright County and Webster County are just dominated with information about fruit trees. And so it was greatly popular. And that was what a lot of the business was. But the Great Depression, the drought of the 1930s killed a lot of them.
It, when in those days, people had to depend upon their land more.
Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't,
they didn't just go to the grocery store and buy everything.
Yeah.
They couldn't afford that. You had to do everything you could on your land, and that's why you planted so many different crops. You had so many, I mean, we've heard Dad talk about, they had pigs on the farm. They had goats. They had turkeys. They had all kinds of stuff. And it was, you raised all kinds of diversity where, honestly, in this day, you see a lot of this where we ought to take a page out of their book and learn to diversify on our farms more.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the 1928 listings, there's a couple listings right there less than 10 miles from our farm, and every one of the listings mentions fruit trees. A big thing in the area was the creamery in the town of Mansfield, where a lot of people took their milk and had cheese and other things made. And I guess they sold the milk there, talked about how many milk cows you could carry or how many milk cows sold with the farm, then chickens. You can definitely tell there's a very large amount of different species on the farms, go ahead.
I'm sure you've heard Grandpa tell the stories of taking wheat and corn to have it ground there at Bryant Creek at the spring.
Yeah.
What's now the fish hatchery.
That's right.
People would ride horses or take stuff over, would take corn and wheat and have them ground.
Yep.
That they would grow on their place and harvest them and take them there.
Yep. And so basically there was all kinds of stuff going on, and our farm is no different. You worked the land, you lived off the land, but you also, I'm sure back in those days, 1,000 fruit trees was a lot of money, and not only was it a lot of money, but it was a great investment because you could plant those fruit trees and then harvest all the fruit every single year, hopefully, and take that to town or sell it and make some money, and so it was interesting. 1892, he sold that farm, what was that? 60 years later, in 1952, our grandpa bought it back, and then expanded upon that. And if it was 80 acres, I believe it was, is now turned into 275, give or take, and so just kind of built it into the farm it is as we know it today.
I was trying to remember. Do you remember how much Grandma says they paid for the front piece?
No, I think I thought it was like $500 or $400.
Yeah, that's the one that blows my mind when she tells me how much they paid for the front piece. It's like, boy, it's too bad land prices aren't like that right now for us.
Yep, no doubt. I'd buy the whole county if it was that price. You know what they say, you don't want to own the land that you don't want to own all the land, just the land that touches yours. Yep. And so kind of an interesting story for us. The Stark brothers bought it, and of course it left the Keith family. It ended up switching numerous times in that 60 years, and at one point the U.S. government owned it. And then it went back to Grandpa and Grandma in 1952, and I believe that's the year they got married or shortly after, and moved, built a house right there on the farm, and that's the cabin today. It's been around a long, long time, and that's really kind of now fast-forwarding. That's where the story for us, the connection really happens. We grew up 8 miles away in town, but every single weekend, it seemed like, and multiple times during the week, if we could, we went to the family farm with Dad.
It was every Saturday morning, you woke up and ate fried eggs and fried potatoes and then watched Gunsmoke and headed to the farm.
That's right, and a lot of stories with the farm. Of course, the farm is, like I said, 275 acres, mostly... I don't know, kind of, it's kind of mixed, if you want to say 50%, it may be 60-40, but open ground to timber ground. But really, if you look at the soil site and the ecological history, it's woodland, upland woodland. So understanding that landscape is really kind of, it should be kind of a mix of open ground to wooded, going to more forest in the bottom ground, but, a lot of native grasses, wildflowers, historically speaking, to big blackjack trees, post oak trees, a few white oaks, and on down in the valleys of forest. And it's really not too far from that, from a grand scheme of things, if you look at the bones of the property. But a lot more non-native cool season grass in the form of orchard grass and fescue, and then you got your legumes of the clover. Chad, what are your thoughts on that?
It's one of those, we always talk about the wolfy trees, and it's one where you can walk through a lot of the timber that's now solid timber, that there's still those big wolfy post oaks that you're like, that tree's been here a long time. I would like to see what this looked like when this tree was even 20 years old, just to see, because you know a lot of that, trees don't get wolfy with a lot of competition. I mean, you and I were talking about this today in tree stand, looking at trees and how they were self-pruning.
Yes. And by self-pruning, we mean a lot of people that have been around fruit trees know of pruning fruit trees, where you go in and you basically cut the limbs that aren't going to be very good or could possibly harm the tree. And by very good, I mean not going to produce a lot of fruit. And if it does, it's going to weight that limb down to where if it could break and open that tree up for disease and other harmful infections, if you will. And you see these lower level limbs in the hardwoods dying, and it's basically
a lot of time it's in trees that are very tightly packed. There's a high,
if you're in
high stalking rate,
if you're in pine country, you know this, because it forces those trees to grow straight and not have a lot of limbs causing knots in the lower levels, so you get higher value in your timber. But in oak trees, they can do the same thing, but it's not healthy for the tree because it's focused so much on upward growth. It's not making as many reproductive acorns, basically, so there's not as much food for the animals. And they're not.
Well,
they're
it's not bad in young, actively growing trees.
Yes.
But it's when they've completely canopied out and grown as tall as they're going to grow, that's when you see the trees that are in the overstory, they will self-prune. And then the trees that are not in the overstory, they just die off.
That's right. And so that's when you get into the harmful effects of what's the long-term health of this forest going to be. But since this is a not the Habitat podcast. We won't spend too much time on that, but that's really kind of what we've seen transform on the family farm. What was once the premier, and we've heard our family talk about it for years, but the premier quail habitat and hunting that occurred in the area, to now it's very little quail. Fewer deer than there used to be, and there's probably a few more turkeys just because they can tolerate the effects of cattle farming. But overall, the quail population has plummeted, and as well as woodcocks and all the other upland species.
Well, that's what's crazy to me. There is a neighboring farm close that Dad talks about used to be pretty open, like scattered post oaks and open and grassy.
Yep.
And now you drive by and it's solid timber. Like complete closed canopy, leaves underneath.
Yep. And a lot of the neighborhood calls what used to be abundant in this area's wild pasture, they'd call it. Which was basically the native landscape, the native warm season grasses, native cool season grasses, and then of course the native forbs. And so huge changes have occurred as far as the specific type of vegetation growing there, but it's not too far removed. A mix of shortleaf pines scattered through the landscape, which are native to the area. But it really, to me, the farm is what really shaped the passion that I have today, and as well as you, Chad. And I know that's true for Matt as well with his family farm. Is as a child, I feel like that's why it's important to really try to, if you want your kids to be kind of nature lovers or outdoorsy, you've got to find those ways to introduce them at a young stage before it's too late.
And it's not even, it's introducing them to nature.
Not hunting specifically, yeah, nature
it's
in
just,
general.
And it's crazy to think of the people our age that can't identify trees. And that was something that I thought of as fundamental just with Dad. I mean, you went on the farm and that was something that he taught us.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's definitely a good point because you may ask, like, where did our passion come from or how did we... I get asked that question all the time because I'm not a forester. I'm not a certified wildlife biologist, but I know a lot of animal, basically information as well as plant species, and tree species. Like, because the fact that when we were growing up, Dad just constantly was hounding us. Hey, what is that? What is this? What's the name of that?
And it's something I run into, in which you've talked about it before. But I work for the Forest Service, and it's something that I run into with people I work with that. I'll have a biologist that they specialized in fisheries and they know fishes like crazy. But then when it comes to a lot of plants, they're like,
fishes.
they know their fish really well.
Yeah.
But when it comes to plants and stuff, they're like, I don't really know. And it's like, we both have a very, a really good grasp of, at least common names of plants, animals, fish. And it's something we've just been taught through our lifetime as kids.
Because of the farm.
Yes.
If it wasn't for the farm, who knows what we'd be, UPS driver, a school teacher. But there was something about that farm which really fed the fire of the obsession with land. I mean, you went and studied wildlife management. I went and studied agriculture. But it all came back to the fundamental of we got obsessed with land at a very young age because we had access to the farm.
Yep.
Yeah,
and spent countless hours just walking around the farm.
That's why when people ask me, boy, what's your dream farm? Where's your dream farm? Where do you hope to buy land one day? And I always say, realistically, I just want to expand on what we have. I love the land prices compared to the rest of the country when you look at southern Missouri. It's hard to beat that, but you can never put a price tag on the heritage that's involved with the family farm.
Yep.
Is it? What do you think? Do you find it interesting to think about the family farm as like picturing yourself looking at old photos and seeing like, man, I'm on the same piece of ground, as corny as it sounds, we're on the same dirt that great grandpa was on, that dad was a kid on.
You and I have both looked through pictures of some of those old pictures of the farm, like the front gate and like the pines across the road that dad planted. And now they're mature pine trees with a ton of pine seedlings that need thinned, but
it's
that was a piece of land
anymore.
that grandpa used to own and sold off.
Yep.
And you're like, boy, I'd like to go in there and thin those pines and see what it actually turns into and not just be just
dog hair
stacked
thick
in pine seedlings.
Yep. For sure. I find it like, and there's certain things that our grandpa did that I know we would have struggled with seeing if we were both trying to manage at the same time. For instance, he had a major white oak allergy. When white oak trees were pollinating in the spring, he had major allergies because of that. And therefore, when he cut firewood, he really tried to focus on cutting out white oaks.
Oh, that's what I remember planting those. I had those. I don't remember where I got them. We had extras or something. I had some white oak seedlings from the MDC nursery, and which it's Missouri Department of Conservation has a state nursery that you can buy seedlings really cheap.
Yeah, and Tennessee, I think New Hampshire or Maryland has one as well.
It's a great program.
Yep.
But I had some white oak seedlings, and I was going and planting them, and your dad and our dad was just like, yeah, your grandpa would roll over in his grave if you knew you guys were planting white oak trees.
Yeah.
He's like, he couldn't stand them. I'm like, really? Why? He's like, the pollen. He didn't like the pollen. It bothered him really bad. It's like, huh.
Yep.
And you know, in the same sense, even just in our lifetime, there are things that we did when we first started working on the farm that we would kick ourselves now.
Oh, for
knowing
sure.
Knowing what we did, what we were trying to do, what we thought we were doing good.
Plowing and disking is one of the biggest ones that
comes
to mind. And
even as far as I would love to have taken tree measurements before we ever started cutting TSI.
Yep.
Because there's places that I can look at the trees and say, it's done a lot of good, but we lost a lot of great information that we could have had just in managing that timber.
That's right. I think maybe that's motivation to other people that are currently doing stuff on their farm that don't live by our mistake and not take notes of the stuff that's changing and that you're doing on the farm, because who knows? And another big thing, taking pictures. I wish we'd have taken so many pictures back in the day of what the landscape looks like when we were kids versus now. And especially as we start to revamp and do a lot of stuff, we go into more of a rotational grazing type of management. We go into all kinds of different types of things that we're doing on the farm. It's going to be crucial for us to take notes and take
honestly,
pictures.
In those days, it was not as easy as it is now, because now we go to cut and I automatically pull my cell phone out and take pictures.
Yeah.
At that time, that wasn't an option.
No.
I mean, we might've had cell phones, but they didn't have the quality of camera
phones
that they have now.
No. I didn't have a cell phone until I was 18 years old.
So it wasn't as easily done to just go out and take pictures of everything before we go and cut it.
That's right. And, also it was just, I mean, you think about it, even trail cameras, going to the hunting, we used to get our 36 photos and take it a 1 hour development and get it back and have three good pictures. It's changed a lot.
Yes.
And I'm really like, to me, there's so much sentimental value. I'm a very sentimental guy anyway, but there's so much, there's so much to be said about managing and living on the, or hopefully one day living on the same farm that our ancestors lived on. And to me, that all goes, that's not downplaying or bashing anybody that's out there moving around and flipping farms and having a good time doing that. But there is a power into looking at what you're improving as the same thing your grandpa or your great grandpa worked to improve when he was on this earth. And that really goes with our company name of Land and Legacy. Is it's kind of a motivational and inspiring thing to think about the magnitude of what you're doing, and how that really is just kind of, it's something powerful. It's something, it's good for the soul to think about, of the amount of, influence you're having on just wonderful gift of land.
Yeah. To go in and, you know, it's one that you're not only, you're hoping to do something that's not only benefiting you, but it's benefiting generations to come. I mean, a lot of work that you're doing and hopefully like your guys' reach through the podcasts and videos to be able to hopefully inspire more people to want to do work on their land to improve it for generations to come.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's a good time to wrap it up. We've been here about 30 minutes, and it's a little shorter this week just because of the lack of interviews with agents. But we'll be right back at it full swing next week with our three more podcasts coming out. And I know Matt and I have a busy, busy spring ahead of us and late winter. I guess you say spring anytime you look at, for me, it's always, oh, the spring schedule, which starts in January, February, March. But we definitely have a we have a busy workload, so we're going to have a lot of great content coming out. So make sure you subscribe to our channel on iTunes and check everything out, like our pages, and follow along. And, Chad, appreciate you joining us once again. And
good to be back, and I'm sure it won't be the last with your guys' busy schedules.
That's right. That's right. So, anyway, hopefully you guys enjoyed it, and we'll catch you next week.